This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Earlier this week, Terry spoke with writer Tobias Wolff. If you had known Wolff during the time covered in his new memoir, you'd probably be quite surprised at the course his life has taken since then. Wolff's new book, In Pharaoh's Army, is about his tour in Vietnam. He joined the Army after he was kicked out of a prep school he had gotten into by forging letters of recommendation. He became a first lieutenant, but by his own account was a lousy officer. Today, Tobias Wolff is waiting to see if his new memoir will win the National Book Award. His earlier novel, The Barracks Thief, won a Penn Faulkner Award, and the memoir of his childhood, This Boy's Life, won the L.A. Times Book Award. It was made into a movie with Ellen Barkin as his mother and Robert De Niro as his abusive stepfather. Wolff has also won awards for his short story writing, and he edited two recently published short story collections, The Best American Short Stories for 1994 and The Vintage Book of Contemporary American Short Stories. Terry Gross recorded this interview with Wolff earlier this week. He began with a reading from his new memoir.
The men I'd respected when I was growing up had all served, and most of the writers I looked up to. Norman Mailer, Irwin Shaw, James Jones, Eric Maria Remarque, and of course Hemingway, to whom I turned for guidance in all things. Military service was not an incidental part of their histories. They were unimaginable apart from it. I wanted to be a writer myself, had described myself as one to anybody who would listen since I was 16. It was laughable for a boy my age to call himself a writer on the evidence of two stories in a school lit mag. But improbable as this self-conception was, it nevertheless changed my way of looking at the world. The life around me began at last to take on form, to signify. No longer a powerless confusion of desires, I was now a protagonist, the hero of a novel to which I endlessly added from the stories I dreamed and saw everywhere. The problem was, I began to see stories even where I shouldn't, where what was required of me was simple fellow feeling. I turned into a predator, and one of the things I became predatory about was experience. I fetishized it, collected it, kept strict inventory. It seemed to me the radical source of authority in the writers whose company I wanted to join, in spite of their own coy deference to the ugly stepsisters' honesty, knowledge, human sympathy, historical consciousness, and, ugliest of all, hard work. They were just being polite. Experience was the clapper in the bell, the money in the bank, and of all experiences, the most bankable was military service.
Now, how did you become predatory about experience?
It's a way of, I'm describing here a way of standing back from your life and the lives of others, becoming almost by design an observer rather than a wholehearted participant in what's going on. It isn't something that necessarily improves the character, but I have noticed it as a quality in almost every writer I know. You don't tell a writer something that you don't want to read later. And this is the kind of thing I'm talking about. Donald Hall has a poem. I can't remember the name of it now. Oh, yes, I do. Advice to a Young Poet. And in this poem, he counsels the young poet not to be caught in this same trap. And he says, you know, when you go to a funeral, don't be looking around thinking about how you would frame this scene in your poem and how you would create this emotion and recapture this experience. Grieve, he says. Grieve. That's what you're there for. And then after you finish the poem and you're in complete agreement with everything he says, you realize that he has done exactly what he's counseling the young poet not to do in a way. He's taken an occasion of grief and turned it into a poem.
Did you go to Vietnam expecting one day you'd get a book out of it?
I don't remember thinking that exactly, but I probably did have it in mind that I would someday write about it. I know that when I came to write this book, both my brother and my mother sent me letters that I'd written there. And there's something about the very posed and phony quality of those letters that suggests to me that I did indeed have it in mind to write a book about it. They were completely useless to me, in fact, in writing this book, because they were so posed. And so I've had to fall back on what, in fact, was the right thing for me to use anyway, which was my memory.
What did you say in those letters that strikes you now as so phony?
Well, I didn't mean to be, I think, but when I went over there in 1967, the war already had a kind of cliched quality in the American imagination. You know, the helicopters whopping over the rice paddies and the civilians fleeing the burning village, all that kind of thing that was showing up on the news that was both truth and cliché by the time I got there. But the problem was that it isn't so much that you're trying to deal in clichés as that your mind gets captivated by them without you really being aware of it. And so there was that quality, I think, in the letters that I sent home of basically repeating what everyone already knew anyway and not really seeing what was going on around me. It kind of put a blindfold between me, I think, and the experiences I was having, because they didn't conform to the stereotypical experiences or the experiences that one expected to have over there. And the other thing is, just as a young man, I was, I think, 21 when I went over, there's a certain amount of bravado and posturing in the letters that perhaps is forgivable in a 21-year-old, maybe even natural, but it didn't give me any help in writing this book, because the pose is really intended to obscure rather than to elucidate.
It was about a couple of weeks before you went to Vietnam that you let a parachute jump, and you misjudged.
Yes.
Where you're going to land. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, I was put in charge of another man's team on a training maneuver, and he was called out at the last minute for some reason or other, and I was just back from a year in language school at the time, and I basically, to make it short, was responsible for these men jumping out of a small plane over a burning garbage dump, which I had mistaken for smoke signals, and you can imagine how I endeared myself to them. It also gave something of a promise of things to come, I'm afraid.
See, they landed in this big garbage dump.
Yeah, most
of them did. Because you miscalculated.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of feelings did this give you about your leadership skills?
Well, you might have asked them. I was beginning to have a pretty good idea of my leadership skills by then, I'm afraid. And, you know, I after a couple of years in the Army sent me to officer's candidate school. And because I scored well on these tests, but I should mention that, you know, one of the questions on this test, and I'm not kidding, is how do you pour a glass of beer without raising too big a head on it? And I had a lot of experience pouring glasses of beer, and I was able to answer that question with some accuracy. By answering that question well and others like it, I was passed on to officer's candidate school from the enlisted ranks. I graduated at the bottom of my class, and it wasn't all that miserable a performance, since only about half of us graduated. But I was not intended to graduate. They intended to wash me out, but they discovered right at the end of the training cycle, the 6 months that we spent there, that I was the only one who could. I had been writing these songs for people to sing and organizing a chorus just to amuse myself, and because they needed to stage this kind of review at the end when the class graduated for the post commander and the parents of the graduating officer cadets and whatnot. And they discovered when the moment for the final cuts came that I was the only one who could stage this farce, and which was, I described it generously there, and so they kept me on to produce it, and it was and that was how I became an officer in the Army, and it was, you know, the first of many farces that I was to produce as an officer.
One of the stories that you tell in your book is about Thanksgiving of 1968, when you just fixated on the idea that you needed to see the Bonanza Thanksgiving special on a big TV as opposed to the small, crummy TV that you were used to watching. So you took a fairly long, dangerous trip in which you were nearly killed and you did some damage yourself along the way. Why was it so important to watch the Thanksgiving special of Bonanza?
Well, we got very attached to American things over there, as you can imagine we would. And there was nothing more American than Bonanza, with its, you know, majestic landscape and good, commonsensical, taciturn, self-sufficient men, and its heroic values. It was about as different, of course, from Vietnam as anything could be, and I guess that was why we got so drawn into it. But yes, we had this tremendous appetite. You know, people would fly would helicopter pizza into the fields over there for the troops, and you know, that's just one example of thousands I could give of the odd way we tried to bring our home tried to make ourselves at home there.
Now, did you have any feelings about Bonanza when you were in the States before you went to Vietnam?
No, none at all. No, I don't think I ever watched it much. You know, I knew the theme song, but it wasn't an addiction.
So I'll save the really long, complicated story by which you finally got this TV and the strange circumstances under which you actually watched the Bonanza special. But when you did see it, how did it make you feel?
Great. It was worth it, every bit of it. Yeah, it was like making it home, you know.
There's a reading I'd like you to do from early on in the book. I want you to place us.
Okay. This happened really within a day or so of my arrival in the country at the receiving center. There was that night some kind of, as they put it, a probe on the perimeter, and suddenly a lot of weapons were going off, and people were running around, and those of us who just arrived didn't know what was going on. No one came to tell us what was going on. We hadn't received our issue of combat gear, so we had no weapons or ammunition, no flak jackets, not even a steel helmet. We were helpless, and nobody knew or cared. They had forgotten about us. More to the point, forgotten about me. In this whole place, not one person was thinking of me, thinking, Christ, I better take a run over there and see how Lieutenant Wolf is doing. No, I wasn't on anybody's mind. And I understood that this was true, not only here, but in every square inch of this country. Not one person out there cared whether I lived or died. Maybe some tender hearts cared in the abstract, but it was my fate to be a particular person. And about me as a particular person, there was an undeniable, comprehensive lack of concern. It isn't true that not one person cared. I cared. It seemed to me I cared too much. Cared more than was manly or decent. I could feel my life almost as a thing apart, begging me for protection. It was embarrassing. Truly, my fear shamed me.
Do you think you were alone in that fear? I mean, don't you think everybody else
No.
was probably feeling that too?
No, but we all hid it from each other, and so we all thought we were alone in it, I think. You didn't talk, I mean, you know, you it doesn't do any good to talk about being afraid. It doesn't make you any less afraid, and you don't talk about it in a situation like that. But no doubt others were feeling it too. They had to have been.
Terry Gross's guest is writer Tobias Wolff. His new memoir about his time in the Vietnam War is called In Pharaoh's Army. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry Gross's interview with writer Tobias Wolff.
As readers of your first memoir, This Boy's Life, know, and as readers of your brother's memoir, The Duke of Deception, know, your father was a con man who used many different names and made up many different pasts. And when you came back from the war and lived in San Francisco for a while, you got very close with your father for a short while. He'd gotten out of prison while you were in officer candidate school. Why was it easier for you to strike up a good tone with your father during that time when you got back from the Army?
Well, to begin with, Terry, to describe my father as a confidence man is, I think, in some ways to glamorize what he was, because Americans really love confidence men, and even though they pretend not to. But we think of them as being the most American of figures. And the guy with the scheme, the scam, he's just the kind of outlaw version of somebody who started IBM, right? In fact, he was a desperate man whose pathology was to invent pasts for himself so that people would love him, I think. And he never had a real scheme. He never had a plan. He never sold stocks to non-existent companies or anything like that. They were all really kind of improvisational, shall I say, and supremely unsuccessful. And to tell you the truth, I'd always judged him very harshly for this, partly because I recognized in myself some of the same tendencies, in fact, many of the same tendencies. And as I suppose a way of declaring to myself that I was not him, I judged him very harshly and was embarrassed for him and ashamed of him. My own experiences and my own acquaintance with my capacities for behaving in ways that I would not have thought myself capable of, ways in which I had disappointed myself over the years, and particularly in the compass of this book here, basically disabled my will and my ability to judge him. I just didn't want to anymore. I thought, by the time I got back, I was thinking about my own soul and noticing that it had that it needed a lot of work. Less inclined to judge his for that reason, and I think my father felt this, sensed it, and he warmed up tremendously, opened up, and we just became very, very good friends in the time after I got back.
So, did this period with your father leave you feeling any different about him, or understanding him any better than you had in the past?
Yes, really. He had been always in some ways a rather formidable and even kind of frightening figure to me. And he was, when I knew him after he got out of prison, when I got back from Vietnam, he was a very tender man, very sweet and vulnerable man, who didn't have long to live, though he didn't know that, and I didn't know that, and was intensely desperate for the love and company of his son. And I was very happy to give it.
When you came home and you started to write, what were you writing about?
When I got home from Vietnam, what was I writing?
Mm-hmm.
I was writing a novel about Vietnam, actually, but... it wasn't very good. It wasn't any good at all. But and what was really wrong with it is it just had nothing at all to do with my experiences there. Again, it was a kind of posed or received picture of it. It was, in an odd way, a way of avoiding thinking about what I had done and been over there, so that it didn't carry very far. But the important thing for me was that I just started writing again. Just the discipline of writing again meant everything to me.
Chronologically, your new memoir ends with you going to Oxford. You've said that this is going to be your last memoir. Why wouldn't you want to write another one?
Well, I don't know that the kind... My life has been exciting to me since... but in ways that I'm not sure would be exciting to anyone else. My excitements tend to be, frankly, rather intellectual excitements, cerebral, spiritual excitements. And for that reason, I think I'm probably going to trust my imagination to produce the stories that will give me rein for those, to express those kinds of excitement rather than the the struggle for survival that I guess my first two books is about.
I think I know what you mean, though, about what the problem would be. I know often when I interview somebody, I tend to focus on their more formative years, when they're figuring out who they are and
right.
they're making themselves into that person.
Exactly.
And then there seems to be a point where somebody becomes the person who they are, and you have a feeling that, you know, they wake up and they did basically what they did the day before, which doesn't mean what they did was uninteresting or unimportant, but there's
a
kind of sameness, this repetition that, yes. that one's life settles into after a certain point.
Yes, exactly.
So that would be hard to dramatize, I
it
guess.
It is. It's harder. It does present a challenge. I think an interesting, example of that kind of thing is if you look at Graham Greene's two memoirs, A Kind of Life and Ways of Escape. A Kind of Life is about him, as you put it, in the process of formation. And it's an extremely exciting and peculiar, eccentric autobiography, or memoir, rather, and very coherent. In the second book, he's who he is, and he has different adventures, but the effect is rather episodic, and you don't feel that the personality is at risk at all. The personality is already coherent and determined, so that it does not have the same excitement, I think, as the first volume for that reason, and that would be my hesitation in taking on this kind of a project again. I won't say I would never write nonfiction again. I can imagine writing nonfiction again, the kind of thing, say, that Norman Mailer does in The Executioner's Song, which is a book I love. And, you know, I could go on naming such books. But I think that the world has heard enough from this gentleman for a while on the subject of his early wild years.
Terry Gross spoke with writer Tobias Wolff. His new memoir, In Pharaoh's Army, has been nominated for a National Book Award. The winners will be announced on November 19th. This is Fresh Air.